Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Thanks for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It's Thursday, October 3rd. All signs point to power lines that ignited dry brush as the cause of Maui's deadly wildfires. We get reaction from the community and other stakeholders. And timeshare trends, the industry is still strong and leading the recovery post-pandemic as timeshare companies get bigger and open new properties, including one in Waikiki this week. Plus, we wrap up our week-long series on impactful teachers. We head to the Big Island to meet a Kohala teacher whose teaching style had an influence on a voice you hear right here on HPR. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The long-awaited report on what caused Maui's fatal wildfire points to Hawaiian Electric Company's power lines and Kamehameha School's unmanaged vegetation on its lands that fueled the blaze. It did absolve the county's fire department on its response. We have team coverage on the report this morning. We start with HPR reporter Catherine Kluwit-Pachtel, who was at that news conference on Maui and who talked to community members. Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning.
Yeah, so what was the reaction from the folks you talked to?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that came out of the report was that it wasn't two separate fires. It was a reignition of that morning blaze. And I think that's something that community members I spoke with really emphasized. You know, they all had a lot of gratitude for the fire department and the belief that they really did everything that they could. You know, there was no blame in the residents that I talked to whatsoever on the fire department. And some people that I checked in with, you know, intentionally didn't read or watch the press conference of this report for their mental health. And I think that's something really important to acknowledge. And some people who did look into it didn't feel like it really brought any more closure after all of these months of waiting, as you said. And some others said, you know, they were just busy doing other stuff and didn't really prioritize checking it, which I think also speaks to kind of what the report, you know, indicates for them. Some themes in the feedback of the folks that I talked to, you know, shared there wasn't really any new information out of this report. And, you know, some of them expressed that it was kind of anticlimactic. But, you know, folks, said that they were, you know, just a variety of reactions to it. Jordan Ruidas is an organizer of Lahaina Strong. She talked about the trauma that reports like this can bring up for people.
I'm choosing to not watch the whole thing just because of, you know, the heavy nature of it. A lot of times when things like that come out, yes, I know the officials want to bring clarity to the people, but it's almost like re-traumatizing all over again. When they came out the 1 year or the 6 months, whatever it was, it took me almost 2 weeks to kind of like my nervous system to like recoup. So it's a really heavy feeling when things like this come out. I think everybody is just working really hard to just be solution-based and how can we move forward? How can we get back on our properties? How can we rebuild? So yeah, while some are looking to this, a lot of people are just like, okay, let's just, you know, look positively towards the future.
Yeah, you don't blame them.
Yeah, for sure. And Jordan Ruidas also mentioned that recently the Lahaina community has lost a number of people, some of which to suicides, you know, some to other causes. But she encouraged people, you know, to look toward the positive work that is being done in the community. There's, you know, she mentioned community-led energy projects, native plant restoration, water restoration, you know, rather than focusing if the report brings you to that place of trauma, rather than focusing on that. So here's Charles Nahale. He lost his home on Front Street in the fire.
As someone who experienced the fire firsthand, the reports seem somewhat cut and dry and simple, if I may put it that way. Although I know they said that they had spent a lot of time, a lot of energy, a lot of people into getting the information that they needed to be able to give this report to Gate today. But the intensity, the volume, and the mass of that fire consuming the town as it did so quickly. I think I probably was hoping for something brought up that would sort of explain why this fire, other than it being windy, could do what it did so quickly.
Yeah, I think the point of, you know, re-traumatizing the folks that were so intimately involved is, you know, you just got to be sensitive to that.
For sure. And for Nahale, you know, he said it didn't bring that closure for him that, you know, maybe he was hoping for from some type of conclusive report like this. He talked about feeling a lack of trust in the report and like maybe something was being left out or covered up, because he said, you know, based on what he experienced, he didn't feel like it added up quite right for him. You know, he said he's not a conspiracy theorist or anything like that, but he just, you know, he just didn't quite feel satisfied with what the report had to share. And, you know, I think everyone's going to have their own take on it. And, you know, as people pointed out, a lot of the information, you know, wasn't really groundbreaking, but, you know, it is that final report that does share, you know, as much as can be known about the cause. And, you know, at the press conference that I was at, the fire department did say that as far as the reignition, you know, there were some details that just will never be 100% clear. And, you know, where that little ember was that may have re-sparked after, you know, they declared it contained and stayed on the scene for so long afterward, you know, there's just some things that will never be 100% clear about it.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Catherine. We're glad you were there on Maui to cover this.
Thank you.
And HVR reporter Ashley Mizzouo joins us in studio now. She talked to policymakers and one attorney who filed a lawsuit for families that lost loved ones and their homes. So, Ashley, this report was 300 pages long, and lots of the information was blacked out.
Yeah, so this report was by the U.S. Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives and Maui County. And, you know, to note, it's separate from the reports that were commissioned by the Attorney General's office, which the second phase came out from the Attorney General's report last month. They made it a point during the press conference yesterday about this ATF report that, unlike the Attorney General report, there were a lot of redactions, especially of personnel names, which Maui County said was out of respect and specifically mentioned that it differed from the AG's report. The ATF also signed an NDA with HECO to not reveal critical infrastructure information that could be used by bad actors to compromise our infrastructure. And so I think those kind of things were the reasons why there was so much redacted from this. But what was not redacted was what they determined to be the cause and origin of the fire, which again was the downed power lines and unmanaged vegetation. That morning fire was caused by the re-energization of broken utility lines, which belonged to Hawaiian Electric Company. And then there was a rekindling event that happened in a gully on Kamehameha School's land, which a piece of smoldering material hidden in unmanaged vegetation was fueled and reignited by a severe wind event, and that's when the fire resumed. As Catherine said earlier, the report is not definitive on how the fire got into that gully area. It could have been heavy equipment pushed the smoldering material into the gully when it was trying to clear a fire break earlier. It's possible that wind blew it into the gully. They said that we might just never know what exactly got it into that rekindling event happened in that gully, but just that it had happened, and it was a lot of it to do with unmanaged land. You know, in a statement, HECO says that it deeply regrets its operations contributed to the fire. It says it'll be implementing changes to better secure and protect the state's infrastructure.
Yeah, I did see reports or statements out from Kamehameha Schools. I mean, I understand that they were cited by the county, I think it was in 2019, for not keeping all that brush in check and didn't really follow up.
Right, right. And I think that, you know, while this investigation has gone on for over a year now, the results just aren't surprising to anyone. Litigation teams working on the lawsuits against HECO, the state, and large landowners like Kamehameha Schools have already presented similar findings. I spoke with Michael Watts, an attorney representing Maui survivors, as part of that $4 billion settlement. And he says the ATF report just makes those public.
As one of the lead lawyers that represents over 3,000 people in this fire, I knew exactly what happened, but I couldn't talk about it outside of litigation. And so now it's a public document for everyone to see. And that is healing, it's cathartic, and it's also important in terms of preventing another wildfire in the future.
And he says because of that, this really has no impact on the settlement, which is awaiting a decision by the Hawaii Supreme Court because there's a disagreement between plaintiffs and insurance companies on further litigation. Insurance companies want to be able to go after those who are part of the settlement, such as HECO, the state, Kamehameha Schools, independently, and also recover claims from Maui victims who get settlement money. So the lawyers representing victims say it's a money grab by insurance agencies, which could bankrupt those involved in the settlement, leaving the victims with nothing. So until that decision is made by the Hawaii Supreme Court, we're not going to have that settlement finalized, but a decision is expected early next year.
And you also talked to lawmakers.
Yeah, I spoke with State Representative Ellie Cochran, who represents Lahaina, and she wants to see more action going into preparation for future wildfires.
The report is a report, which I'm not totally surprised about, the outcome and what's been talked about. But what I am surprised is that it's how many months later, and I still don't really feel there's a solid answer, solutions, or a mitigation plan to address what we already know has happened and to be preventative on a bigger level, not just everybody just take care of your own household thing.
And that was something during the Maui County's presentation, officials were asked about, you know, lessons learned. And what was emphasized is the public's responsibility to protect themselves, such as hardening their homes. But Representative Cochran says, you know, there needs to be more in place, like ensuring there's enough water supply in Lahaina, especially with so many temporary housing being built in the area and backup communication networks that need to be set up, which failed during that August fire. And she wants to see more enforcement of land management laws to curb the unmanaged vegetation, which largely contributed to the fire. So here's what they said. Here's Maui Fire Chief Brad Ventura.
Our plan is to send out our inspectors pre-fire season and notify landowners if the vegetation needs to be managed, and if so, notify them. When we give a notice of warning and followed by a notice of violation, we give direct orders on what to do to the land and to maintain it. Therefore, we shouldn't have to go back to babysit lots over and over again.
And so I think, you know, this upcoming legislative session, we're going to see some of these land management laws coming through to either incentivize landowners to better manage the land or increase penalties to get them to comply. So we'll be seeing that in January when the legislative session resumes.
All right. But at least we have a cause, and then the policymakers can get to work.
Yep.
Thanks so much,
Thank
Ashley.
You.
We have been hearing from HVR's Ashley Mizuo and Catherine Kluwapaktel, who they both covered the release of this long-awaited report on the cause of last year's Maui wildfires and reaction to the conclusion. Look for their stories on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
Ever, Israel faced down a large-scale missile attack by Iran with the help of its most important ally.
The United States military coordinated closely with the Israeli Defense Forces to help defend Israel against this attack.
But there is daylight between the U.S. and Israel. That's next time on The World.
Beginning this afternoon at 1.
Support for HPR comes from the Scheidler College of Business at UH Manoa, celebrating 75 years, offering the distance learning executive MBA and Master of HR Management. Scheidler.hawaii.edu/executive.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, your backyard quiz.
Onihoa, olehua, onihau, okaua, oahu, omolokai, olanai, omaui, okaholabe, ohawaii.
Today we're taking you deep into the history of a popular local condiment. Recently, shoppers have been delighted to find that a teriyaki-based cooking sauce has come back in stock at major retailers. The sauce was created by a Japanese man named Junki, who immigrated to Seattle at the age of 19. It's said that with just $5 to his name and a secret family recipe for teriyaki sauce, he was able to create a successful international business. In 2000, Junki sold his beloved sauce brand to the Heinz Company, which continued to market it in Asia, but pulled back on its retail presence in the U.S. market. And then this August, more than two decades after selling the teriyaki sauce brand, Junki bought it back from Heinz and has re-entered the Hawaii market. You can once again find the sauce at select grocery retailers like Costco and Amazon. For today's backyard quiz, we want to know, what is Junki's last name? Here's a hint. It's also the name of his teriyaki-based cooking sauce. Call 808-941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. The first one to get it right scores an HPR reusable tote bag.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Nareit Hawaii, which supports nonprofits providing access to affordable housing to those with intellectual and developmental disabilities, including ARC of Maui County. NareitHawaii.com.
Tomorrow, the first new timeshare tower in Waikiki in about 7 years is expected to open for business. The Marriott Vacation Club Waikiki is expected to be at around 90% occupancy, a signal of the strength of the visitor industry. We talked to Jason Gamble, president and CEO of ARDA, the American Resort Development Association, about the latest buying trends. In recent years, millennials and Gen Zers were embracing this timeshare model.
It is one of those great misconceptions that the product is for an older generation only. What we find now is that over 50% of current owners are millennials or Gen Z. And over two-thirds of new buyers are millennials and Gen Z buyers. So I think this is, for one, over the last several years, people have realized the benefits of timeshare accommodations and what they bring. They're spacious, they've got great professional management. There are more destinations, just like the one I was at, the Marriott Waikiki, their new property, which is part of their city collection. And you see so many other developers who are providing urban options for people to travel. So it really appeals to a younger traveler. And let's face it, just like my kids are growing up vacationing in timeshares every year. That has become their standard. I think I could tell them we're going to a luxury hotel. And if they said, well, do we get our own bedrooms? Do we have our own kitchen? Do we have multiple bathrooms? If the answer is no, it's like there's a groan. There's that doesn't sound nearly as much fun.
Yeah, but if they grew up with timeshares, like people grow up listening to, NPR and Hawaii Public Radio in the backseat of the car as a kid, right?
Yeah.
You grow up with it.
Yeah, you grow up with it and you just understand it for all the great things it has to offer. And if you just become a listener, if you're a classic rock fan, then it just follows naturally that you're going to continue that love when you get older, especially as your needs change as a traveler. I understand as young travelers, a lot of times, like I did when I was a kid in my 20s and then maybe early 30s, it was okay to crash on a friend's couch and just do that thing for vacation. person, that when you had a significant other, when I got married, when I had kids, your needs change. Yeah. And just the same way that we see in Gen Z and the millennial world, they're not only changing for the accommodations, but the other thing that is truly, we'll say, all the rage in travel these days, and where I believe Hawaii has been always on the forefront of, is that of experiences, the experiential nature of travel, that you can use your timeshare accommodations as your launch pad. But once you get there, yeah, you still want the accommodations. It's great when you go to sleep to have your own bedroom and have breakfast maybe in the morning ready. But it's where you go and what you do after that, the experiences. And when I was at the HTA conference this week, looking at all the different tourism and experiential providers, those people you could do horseback riding, the tours, the eco tours, the things you can do to experience the culture, just like my last trip to Maui in the timeshare, they had a beautiful cultural center. And my family spent every day, we spent time in the cultural center learning something about Hawaii culture. We learned about the language. We learned about traditional, the weaving. We weaved coasters that we still use today. We learned about indigenous plants and did cleanup. And when people marry the two, the experiential nature of the product along with the fantastic accommodations, and you realize that you could use your timeshare ownership to book some of these great experiential travel, it's fantastic. And I think that's what's really appealing to the younger traveler.
Well, the latest numbers show that, you know, the visitors are spending more, mm-hmm. you know, whether their hotel rooms are higher, but timeshare owners, they do drop a few bucks here and there.
They do. You know, and that's one of the beauties about the product, is that the prepaid nature of it, for somebody who's purchased their vacation and is traveling basically on their maintenance fee, they have already spent their money. If they have paid their maintenance fee the first of the year before they ever travel, they've already purchased the timeshare itself. Now for them, it's easy to budget. They know how much money airfare is. They know how much money their accommodations are going to cost. Now they have a budget for everything else they do when they get on island. And they do spend at the same or higher rate than hotel guests, because at the end of the day, they're not signing a folio over. They don't have to pay the credit card. They've already paid for it. So that's already done. And for them, it's about spending when they get there. And that's when they do spend on artwork. They do spend on local experiences. They spend on memorabilia because they want to take some of that vacation back with them. And they're usually here for 10 or more days. You know, the average length when people come here, they're here for a good decent amount of time.
So what are some other trends that we've seen over this past year since we last chatted?
So the experiential side of it is probably the strongest. From an industry standpoint, you know, we're at interesting times, as we have a good amount of consolidation going on in our industry. Some of the bigger players are getting bigger, just like Hilton Grand Vacations, who acquired a company called Blue Green Resorts that has resorts mostly on the mainland, but that's where they continue to see growth. So for owners, they're getting more options. They're seeing more opportunities for travel and places where they can go. And that experiential nature, as I mentioned, there's a lot of that going on. You also see partnerships, good partnerships that are going on. Travel and Leisure, which has the Wyndham timeshare brand, they just entered into a partnership with Sports Illustrated. So they are going to be doing timeshare resorts on college campuses, along with whole ownership, hotel, and some timeshare. So they're going to have themselves new types of offerings for a different type of traveler. And mm-hmm. that's been something that we have seen interesting. We did just recently released a white paper on what we think the next 3 to 5 years of the timeshare industry looks like. It's one that can be found on our website, arta.org. And it's for us, it was fun because I had a chance to sit down with a lot of leaders and also found out from a technology standpoint, you know, our industry has some catching up to do. Just like as I see major travel providers are trying to meet the consumer on their level, meet their expectations for how they use technology. How are they making reservations on their phone and want to be able to do everything on a one-stop shop? And also seeing how artificial intelligence, AI, is playing into customer service and also the sales and marketing process. So there's some things from a business standpoint that we see taking place. We also see things from consumer shifting, that younger generation becoming more involved in ownership, which means that the destinations and the experiences, the things they're looking for when they get to the resort are a little bit different. And so we see our developers starting to change their ways and their offerings to meet the needs of that younger traveler.
On the short term, things that are out there that are affecting the experience with timeshares, we've got this strike against Hilton. Mm-hmm. Folks are hoping it's not protracted. So I don't know how it's been for the timeshare owners. I don't know what we've heard in the week that you've been here, you know, about what it's been like.
Well, anytime there's disruptions like that, it's always unfortunate because As we know, and not to minimize the seriousness of the issues for the workers themselves, and the industry has always worked with, and we've had a number of industry partners that have worked with unions for years, as they try to reconcile what the issues are. It is always a little disturbing for people who are on vacation that, you know, this was maybe their one big vacation in 5 years to come to Hawaii. And if there is a service interruption, or if there's a housekeeping issue, or if there's something going on where there's something that needs to be fixed in a unit, but there isn't somebody there to do it, it's unfortunate for them, because it will ultimately affect the way they believe it. It suffers, and it will suffer on their overall perception of the state. And of course, there'll be some blowback locally just in that field.
And we were hearing that maybe the guests that were staying at Hilton, maybe a labor dispute wasn't really on their radar. And so I don't know how that all works when you are a timeshare owner and there is a dispute and then you get affected. I mean, you just show up and they're like, oh, okay, I guess we've got a strike situation. Does anybody give them a heads up? I mean, I don't know.
Yeah, I think there's a communication, because the management will want to make sure they can work with the owners in case there are issues and keep them apprised of the issues that are taking place. So there is a good job, and there is always a fantastic job for Hilton and others about the pre-arrival information that a guest might get, especially in issues like this, of what to expect. So that way, when they get there, they're not shocked and they understand the situation at hand. If there's any good news, and there's never good news, but if there's a way for them to work through, I think when they're in residence, there's still ways to continue to make sure that people are comfortable. The way that timeshares normally operate, they don't have that daily housekeeping. So the housekeeping of needs won't be so affected. It may be a little bit more difficult for them, of course, to turn a unit to be ready for the next guest. So there'll be some interruptions there. It's some of the same day-to-day that you have in a hotel operation. But, you know, you've got service workers. You still have people who are there who do maintenance. And if the maintenance workers aren't there, you could have issues there for regular maintenance that needs to be prepared. So there, I think it's important that those developers communicate as best they possibly can, as early as they possibly can, so owners can be prepared to understand what it means to them if there's an interruption in service.
We have seen a situation with the condo insurance affecting sales, particularly with, let's say, buildings that were underinsured. And I don't know, is that having any effect at all on the timeshare properties, timeshare towers?
It does. The overall effect, we see this across the U.S. because it's become one that even I think there's more light, unfortunately, with Hurricane Helene, which caused so much devastation in the Southeast. There were a number of properties, and you take a look at what happens, because even before Helene, there was the Champlain Towers, a collapse that took place South Florida.
Yeah.
And we're still seeing that effect, because everybody now is looking at buildings and taking a look at the studies that have been done to determine, first of all, where are your reserves? Are the reserves fully funded? And do you have money to pay for large repairs if those repairs are necessary? And to get people to do the necessary studies, those reserve studies, as well as structural analysis of buildings. And you're finding, you know, 30, 40 years old, there are going to be some problems in buildings.
Is this situation affecting sales?
I think it affects mostly your current owners, right?
Okay.
Because the maintenance fee payments, which you never like to see raise, people do have to make some adjustments. And so people have making adjustments now to match the current practices with best practices or with state law. And in the overall systems of which these resorts are part of, you could see some increases in fees based upon people having to look at their past decisions and make up for it.
And then with the hurricane, I mean, I don't know, I mean, Florida is number one for timeshare sales. Got some sense as to how that's been affected?
There have been a number of resorts up the West Coast that were affected. We had some that were affected with the hurricanes in prior seasons, or Sarasota, Siesta Key, places in Fort Myers, that resorts that, and the flooding was catastrophic in those areas again from Helene. You also had some along Clearwater Beach in St. Pete that were affected with water intrusion, and of course the issues with ingress, egress, the roads being full of sand and people not being able to get to the resorts. Things will slow down and things will be affected, no doubt, at least in the short term, where some of those resorts were older especially the ones in South Florida. Those might not be in active sales, but there's a number of them that are in active sales there. And you'll also see some resorts in North Carolina that got affected because of the weather. You had a lot in the Panhandle, Panama City. There wasn't any in the direct path of the storm, but you're going to see the ones that were along the coast that suffered either wind damage or water damage. There will be some slowdown, and there'll be some interruptions, I think, in the short term as people go ahead and rebuild or get back up and running.
And then here in Hawaii, what's the forecast? You know, because I know there are, say, owners from Japan that are impacted with the yen.
There is. So you'll see the Japanese visitor in particular, as you can see from all the DBET studies, we still haven't gotten back to that 2019 level of the Japanese visitor. There are, though, both anecdotal and empirical data that shows that the owners, the Japanese owners, are coming back to their properties, not as fast as over as the, we'll just say, average Japanese tourist. And so you'll get people coming back that are owners. It's the newer, or it's the traveler that may become an owner, that's the one that's taken a little while longer to return. And I think that's, from an overall perspective, I think in line with what the rest of the state is seeing without having that Japanese traveler back. Now, interestingly enough, the folks at Hilton Grand Vacations are opening resorts and soon will be opening another resort in Japan. So there is actually a lot of demand for the product in Japan, and that will only continue to, I would say, increase the ties between the Japanese traveler and Hawaii, given it's an 8-hour flight to get here. It's a nice place for people to go on vacation, especially once they experience the resorts there. We'll hope that they'll want to come to Hawaii and move within the same system. So we're cautiously optimistic that things will continue to recover. And in the meantime, for the Japanese traveler that's not coming, this is an opportunity for that mainland traveler or someone from all over the world who has always had that aspirational trip on the books to come to Hawaii. Now is the time for them to exchange and experience it. And that's why we continue to see those occupancy rates in the mid-90s and continue to stay in the mid-90s as people continue to come regardless.
Okay. Anything else? Any other trends that you think would be worth mentioning?
Those are the biggest. And I really think that youth movement is an important one. I find that we get this continued focus by the major hospitality companies in Hawaii, which is continuing to build on it, like the resort I was just talking about. It has its formal opening, or it's open for reservations now, but this Friday is the official opening of the resort, the Marriott Waikiki property. Gorgeous property, 110 rooms. It's already, on day one, will be 90% occupied.
Wow.
So there, you could see that the demand is extremely high, especially for properties when you can be right at the resort. You can look at Lures Street, you can be right there and be in the middle of it all. It ties in really nice and with so many of the other developers that have properties either in the coast areas like Ko'olina. The Ko'olina to that Marriott Waikiki trip, it's a perfect thing for a visitor who spends a little bit of time out in a larger resort beach location that has time to be part of an urban destination and experience the city and all that Waikiki has to offer. It's nice to see. You hope that's going to be the case, but that evidence is that 90% occupancy on day one, and my guess is you'll never see a dip below 90% again, which is exciting.
And that was Jason Gamble, president and CEO of ARDA, the American Resort Development Association, talking to us about the latest trends in the timeshare business. Interesting to note, Florida leads the country in the most number of timeshares. Hawaii is number 5.
Donald Trump and Kamala Harris have sharply differing plans for the American economy. Trump talks about high tariffs and deporting immigrants. Harris wants to tax the wealthy and provide direct help to families. On the next Fresh Air, economist David Wessel will discuss the candidates' plans and records. Join us.
Beginning this afternoon at 3, following On Point.
Support for HPR comes from the Office of Hawaiian Affairs, committed to supporting Native Hawaiians impacted by the Maui wildfires. Applications for its Kanaho grant accepted through October 10th at oha.org/kanaho-grant.
Left you marinating, and now it's time to reveal the answer to today's saucy backyard quiz. Earlier, we told you about the history of a popular local condiment brand created by a Japanese-American entrepreneur. The brand originated in 1982 when founder Jun Ki made a secret family recipe of teriyaki sauce to give out as Christmas presents to friends and family. He turned that idea into a multi-million dollar company that he sold to Heinz in 2000. Well, last month, he negotiated a buyback from the conglomerate and is restocking local retailers with his popular sauce. We asked you for Jun Ki's last name, which is the name of his teriyaki sauce brand that we were looking for. And that was Mr. Yoshida's original gourmet sauce. Ken from Kaka'ako got it right. He says he saw it at Costco. And that's our quiz for today. If you have one to share, write to TalkBack at hawaiipublicradio.org. Saturday happens to be World Teacher Day, and we conclude our week-long salute to impactful teachers with a visit to Hawaii Island. Wendy Nickel is an administrator and teacher at Kohala Middle School. This is her 39th year in education, all at Big Island Public Schools. She started out in 1986 as a sixth grade teacher at Waimea Elementary. And the conversation's Russell Subiono was just 10 years old when he first walked into her classroom. The two reunited in Kona last month.
Awesome. That was Wendy Nichols' reaction upon seeing me after I interrupted a teacher's planning session on the campus of Kealakehi High School. In the nearly 40 years since I was in her sixth grade class at Waimea Elementary, I've crossed paths with her just once, and that was over 15 years ago.
Russell, you remember me?
Of course I remember you.
Oh my gosh.
Good to see you.
I wish we could be in the AC. You know, there's like a lounge, you know.
Okay, you go over there.
Try
yeah, and then I'll tell you what I'm doing here. Don't forget glasses, though.
Yeah.
After surprising Mrs. Nickel at work, essentially, we found a quiet space with air conditioning in the library. I'd coordinated my surprise visit with Kohala Middle School Principal Trisha Sanborn, who was happy to help but asked that I do one thing.
Trisha said I had to get your permission first. So can I have your permission to do this interview and to air it as part of our teacher appreciation series the first week of October?
Sure, but I'm going to start crying.
Here's the backstory. It was 1986. I was 10 and a good kid. I got good grades. But my family was sorting through a rough patch, to put it nicely. So school was my escape, but it wasn't necessarily a refuge. All of my previous teachers, from kindergarten to fifth grade, were good instructors. But they had also been in education for several years and had a very traditional approach to a classroom, which is why a 20-something-year-old, fresh from college, Wendy Nickel, she was Wendy Sitsui at the time, made such a memorable impact on me. She was energetic and personable and hip to the times, and it was in her classroom that I first began to embrace my storytelling dreams. Flash forward nearly 40 years, and you can trace me talking on the radio in this moment right now to the impact she had on me. And so we talked about her beginnings in education and looked back over her still bustling 39-year career. It's my recollection that we were your first class. Is that true?
Yes. It was so memorable because I had so many of you smart Waimea kids, and it was my first time living in Waimea too. Mm-hmm. So very, very memorable that first year. It was so rewarding.
Looking back now, it feels like, you know, you had a lot of energy and you had a lot of excitement for being a teacher. Did you go to UH?
I went to UH, and then I worked like half-time jobs teaching on Oahu, mm-hmm. but I always wanted to come back to the Big Island.
So where did you grow up, and what inspired you to become a teacher?
I grew up in Hilo, Hawaii, and had a wonderful childhood. First generation from my family to go to college. My parents worked really hard to support us in that endeavor. And when I was on Oahu going to UH Manoa, I needed a part-time job. I lived in the dorms. Across the street was an elementary school, and they had jobs for an after-school program. I never thought I wanted to become a teacher. I thought I would go into like a literary career or like maybe even a law career because I was an English major. And then when I worked with students, I was like, oh, I kind of like this. And the supervisory staff started giving me more responsibilities. So after I was done with my English degree, I said, okay, I want to try. So I went into education and got a certification.
And I'm all the better for it, and many of my classmates as well.
Oh, you're making my heart so full.
Had you not become a teacher, what other career would you have pursued? You mentioned that you would have pursued maybe a literary career. Uh-huh. Are you talking about like an author?
Some kind of publishing, or, you know, I was really influenced by Bamboo Ridge, Eric Chalkin. I can't remember the other director for Bamboo Ridge at UH Manoa. They did the literary review from UH Manoa. Or law, because I was really super fortunate to have a group of friends who were involved in the Hawaiian activism movement that was going on. I was privileged to go to Kaho'olawe after PKO got permission, you know, to start going and rehabilitating, attended Hawaiian language conferences. I didn't speak, but being born and raised in Hawaii, not ethnically Hawaiian, but being born and raised in Hawaii and having so much respect, I said, if I'm not going to do these two, you know, like either law or a literary career, I wanted to help people, like education, you know, so it worked out.
You were my sixth grade teacher, and from what I can tell, you still teach sixth grade?
I'm back in the classroom. Okay. I have been teaching sixth grade science. I've been doing many, many different roles at different schools on the Big Island, but my principal asked me to return to the classroom this year because our science teachers had to leave, so she's developing a science team. And so I was happy to say yes. Yeah.
When you became my sixth grade teacher, did you choose sixth grade or did sixth grade choose you?
Mrs. Pat Bergen, who I have mad respect for, chose me. I mean, you apply for a job and you get it. But I always liked older kids, and I was elementary certificated, you know, at that time. So sixth grade was the oldest group I could have.
What I remember about you is that you were kind and you were interested in students on a personal level. I remember you taking extra time to get to know each of us, giving us time to be spotlighted in a way and really shine a light on what made each of us unique. I remember you actually commissioned me to write a play about courtroom procedure, but all I really did was just like rehash what I seen on TV. I didn't do any research. So I look back now and I was like, what was I thinking? That kind of individual focus was not really something I remember in my school years beforehand, but it seems something that teachers are moving toward today or doing more of today. Why did you want that to be your style of teaching?
Every individual deserves respect. And also it was first year teacher, like desperately trying to keep you guys all involved and really into what we're doing, because sometimes, you know, what we have to teach, you might not be so interested in. But if you can, like you, Russell, you were so fun and you were so smart. It was like, I got to tap into this kid somehow, you know, like what his strengths are. And you were always willing to speak out. So you have to kind of look at what the kid's strengths are, you know, and even the quietest ones. Yeah, you have to try to find out.
Thank you for doing that, because storytelling has always been a huge part of my life. At that time in my life, it was just something that I had a compulsion to do and I felt like would make me interesting. But as I've grown, I find that it's really my calling. Another thing that I remember about you is that you were such a huge fan of Cyndi Lauper. Does your heart still beat for her today?
I still have the sweatshirt. I don't know if you remember. Yes. I went to her concert and I showed it to you all, the white sweatshirt with Cyndi Lauper on it. And I still have it to this day. I take it out every so often and it gets washed so it doesn't get all musty and it gets tucked back in. In fact, I'm going on a trip tomorrow. Maybe I should go dig it out and like wear it. I don't know. Anyway, oh my gosh, I am still a huge fan. Yeah. She's on my playlist. You know, when I'm working by myself in my classroom, she and The Green and, you know, various, but Cindy's on my playlist.
Every time I see her in something or hear her music, I immediately think of you. You're the biggest Cyndi Lauper fan I know of.
I was, yeah, I still am, so.
If you were my sixth grade teacher in 1986, that means that you've been teaching for nearly 40 years, or at least been in education for 40 years. I know teaching can be an incredibly rewarding job, but it's also well known that teachers here don't make that much. What's kept you in the profession for so long?
I love being with students. Even when I've been in my resource positions, I've always asked my administrators to give me a homeroom, study hall, advisory, some kind of group that I can just keep working with. You know, things don't change. From then till now, kids always need a trusted adult, you know, that they can talk to. And I love middle school. Like, I went from elementary up to middle school. That's my home for life for the rest of my teaching career. Teachers do not make enough money in the state of Hawaii. Our teachers union really strongly advocates for that, because if you hire people at a decent rate of pay, a working level rate of pay, able to afford a house, you will keep the very best. I feel like I have stayed because I've been fortunate, because Mr. Nickel stayed in as teaching. So we were able to, you know, hui our money together and raise our family together. We were really fortunate. I really worry about the young teachers now.
What's the biggest misconception the general public has about our public school teachers that you would like to see corrected?
I would say, just based on my more recent years, is that at the middle school and high school, we would like our parents to be even more involved, like with the academic pieces. And we try to reach out. You know, there's so many wonderful like online apps now. And the pandemic was bad, but it did teach us a lot about electronic communication, you know, with our parents. So the misconception is that when the kids get older, they need less, you know, like more hands off. It's like, actually, you need to be more hands on because they need you to guide them and support them and really work as a team, with the teachers and the administration at the school. Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Our parents are stretched thin. We all are, you know, and they're struggling too to make ends meet. It's just, it's a new world, you know, this millennium and this whole thing. It's a new world. The kids really need a lot of guidance. And if we can partner with our parents, that would just be like, and the ones that we do partner with, it's wonderful. And so the ones that are struggling, reach out to us. You know, we're here for you.
Do you have a favorite memory from your years in teaching, or maybe like a favorite student?
Oh my gosh, Russell, when I saw you at the door of the library, I was just like, so exciting, so exciting. Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for the time. That's kind of all the questions that I had for you. I'm so happy that I got to be able to talk to you and catch up with you. So thanks so much for your time.
Oh my gosh, Russell. My heart is singing. I am so full of joy. And yeah, just feeling fulfilled today. Thank you. Mahalo to you.
That was Kohala Middle School science teacher Wendy Nickel talking to her former student, HPR's Russell Subiono. And that wraps up our Impactful Teacher series this week. World Teacher Day is this Saturday, October 5th. So don't forget to thank the teachers who have made an impact in your life. That is it for us today. Up tomorrow, we have a Hanaho show for you. It's Aloha Friday, so we'll be taking a closer look at Hawaiian civic clubs and Royal Hawaiian societies. Give us some feedback. Call our talkback line at 808-792-8217 or email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. You can find The Conversation as a podcast on Apple or Spotify. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow for more of The Conversation.